I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
And welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, which, as you know, is one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. We welcome your comments or questions via email at radioinvivo@earthlink.net. And we do have a website for the program, which you can find at home.earthlink.net/radioinvivo. You can access all of our past programs on the website. And after a year and a half of doing the show, it's now quite an extensive archive on the many topics we've featured here on the show, so we encourage you to check it out. And Radio In Vivo is also available as a podcast on iTunes. All you have to do is go to the iTunes site, search Radio In Vivo, and it will bring the program right up on the list, and you can subscribe. And, of course, we've always had podcasts available on the station's website as well, at communityradio.coop. I would like to mention that Radio In Vivo and WCOM have benefited from the support of the multi-talented Claudio Oswald Niedvarok. Claudio is a master storyteller and a performing poet and author, and he is now one of the most recent additions to the roster of DJs here at WCOM. Claudio and musician-composer John Paul McClellan co-host a show called Claudio's Speakeasy here on the station on Tuesdays from 10 to 11 a.m. So we ask you to give them a listen and check out Claudio's website at www.claudioarts.com. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the CIIT Centers for Health Research in Research Triangle Park. CIIT is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences research and education. For more than 25 years, CIIT has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank CIIT for its support. And Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and it is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. And now that we have all the housekeeping out of the way, I want to tell you that last week I had the great pleasure of attending a pizza lunch for journalists and science writers out at Sigma Xi in Research Triangle Park. And I thought the presentation that took place was so interesting, I invited the presenters to join me here today on Radio In Vivo so that we could share their fascinating information with the rest of you. So my guests today are Dr. Kevin Stewart, who is an associate professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at UNC Chapel Hill, and Mary Russell Robertson. Mary, like me, is a freelance science writer. Kevin and Mary Russell have teamed up and published a terrific book called Exploring the Geology of the Carolinas, a Field Guide to Favorite Places from Chimney Rock to Charleston. Kevin, Mary, Mary Russell, good to see you again, and welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Kevin, I'd like to start with you. Can you give our listeners sort of a broad brush overview of the book itself?
Sure. When Mary Russell and I started thinking about this book, one of the themes that sort of kept coming back to us was the notion of what we've started to call a geological imagination. And that is because so much of geology is so unimaginable, I think, to a lot of people. And so when we were first putting the book together, we realized that there are lots of guidebooks to various things that are out on the market, but very few books that really allow people to understand geology sort of in the way that geologists think about geology.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really wanted to write a book that helped people learn how to think like geologists.
I see. Well, tell us a little bit more about, and Mary Russell, feel free to jump in. I'd like to hear a little bit more about this concept of geological imagination, because it is, I guess, central to the book itself. What does that mean to the non-geologist if you're going out to one of these sites? What should you do?
Well, I think that with geological imagination, so much of geology, I think, is unimaginable. So we talk about things being billions of years old, and one of the concepts of geologic time that we try to communicate is how to get people to think about very large numbers and vast amounts of times in ways that are much more accessible, and how to imagine these things. So much of geology is things occurring at time scales that are so much slower than human time scales that we don't really see the changes happening. And so it's hard to imagine these kinds of things. And we wanted to give people some idea of how to think about and imagine kind of geological processes.
Another aspect of geological imagination is being able to, when you're outside and looking around, see beyond the buildings and the trees and think about what's underneath and what came before, what rocks are under your feet, what geological processes might be going on now or in the past, and how those processes have affected the way the landscape looks now and your daily life and our history and culture in the Carolinas. And we have some examples in our book of ways that geology has affected our history and culture in ways that people might not be aware of. So we wanted to bring those kinds of examples to people's attention.
I see. So Mary Russell, when you guys started doing this book, did you have a geological imagination, or is that something you had to acquire?
Well, when I was in college, I majored in geology.
So you had a good start.
Yes, I had a good start. However, I went to college in Minnesota, and the geology in Minnesota is as different as geology could be from the geology here in the Carolinas.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started working on this book with Kevin, I learned an incredible amount about the geology around here that I didn't know, and learned how to look at the geology. Here in the Carolinas, we've been at the edge of a tectonic plate in the distant past many times, and so there's been a lot of continental collisions and rifting, and the rocks are very metamorphosed, and things are rather confusing. It's very different than in Minnesota, where it's been very far away from that kind of tectonic activity for a long time. So I had to learn to sort of develop a different kind of geological imagination.
I see. Well, you've alluded a little bit to teaming up with Kevin, and the story behind the genesis of this book itself and how you two got together is really interesting. Mary Russell, would you share some of that with us?
Sure. In 1995, I was working on an earth science curriculum project, and through that, I met a retired geology professor named Bob Butler, and I asked him if he could recommend for me a book about the geology of the Carolinas for laypeople. And he said, unfortunately, there wasn't one, and that he himself had been planning to write a book like that for several years, but simply didn't have enough time. So I said, well, gosh, I love geology. I like to write. Let's talk about working on this together. And we did start working on it. We came up with a table of contents together, and he picked out a lot of field sites. The book that Kevin and I have written has 31 field trips in it, and Bob picked out a lot of about half of those. And he and I started working on it together. We put a proposal together for UNC Press. But unfortunately, before we got very far into the project at all, he had a sudden heart attack and passed away. So for several years, nothing happened at all. I I asked a couple of other geologists if they were interested in working on it. In fact, I asked Kevin if he was interested. And at that time, he was not doing a lot of research in the Carolinas. And so he said he didn't feel like he really knew enough about it to work on it at that time. And so several years passed, and Kevin and I worked on some other projects together. We wrote a lab book together. And at the end of that time, he said, you know, I think I am interested in working on that book with you. In the meantime, he had been doing a lot of research in the Carolinas. So we went back to UNC Press, and they were still interested. We put together another proposal that was similar to the one that Bob and I had put together. But we made some changes in the field sites in particular. And then Kevin, in fall of 2003, got a fellowship that allowed him to take a semester off teaching to work on another project. So we spent that fall driving around the Carolinas, visiting all these field sites that are in our book, and that's how the book got started. So it was a bit of a long road.
Absolutely, but all to our benefit that it has come to fruition. Kevin, well, let me ask you, you're an academic. What's it been like for you having published a popular book like this and getting out and making appearances and doing radio shows and things like that?
Well, it's very different from the things I normally do. And I have to say that I really enjoyed the experience. And it's one of the things that I think we sometimes don't get to do as academic scientists is get a sense of whether or not the work that we're doing is really affecting people outside of our discipline.
Sure.
And so when we write technical articles for geology journals, those in the community will read them, but we certainly know that nobody else will. And so it's invigorating, I find it, to find out that people outside of the profession are actually interested in geology. And so going on radio shows and giving talks about our book has been really a lot of fun for me, and it's giving me a lot of motivation to keep thinking about how to communicate geology to folks who aren't necessarily geologists. So I've really enjoyed that part of it quite a bit.
Okay, well, this is a good opportunity to do some more of that. And I know it's going to be a bit challenging to relate some of the fascinating information that you include in the book without the aid of visuals that can illustrate what you're talking about, but we'll do our best with that. Maybe we'll invent another concept called geological visualization.
Perfect.
Kevin, I understand that the wide variety of interesting and significant geological formations in the Carolinas mainly stems back to the activity generated by plate tectonics, as Mary Russell mentioned. What are plate tectonics, and how have they influenced the geology in this region?
Well, plate tectonics really explain a lot of the geology that we see in the Carolinas. And plate tectonics is essentially an overarching theory in geology that describes how the outermost shell of the Earth is broken up into discrete tectonic plates. And these plates are all moving around around the surface of the Earth. And so in some places, the plates are spreading apart, and we call those divergent plate boundaries. You can actually stand on top of an active divergent plate boundary if you go to Iceland. Iceland is actually spreading apart. It's getting bigger every year. And there are other places where the plates are coming together, and we call those convergent plate boundaries. Convergent plate boundaries are often marked by lines of volcanoes, large mountain ranges, and we can find these essentially rimming the entire Pacific Ocean. One part of the Pacific Ocean that isn't rimmed by a convergent plate boundary is our third kind of plate boundary, which we call a transform plate boundary. And the San Andreas Fault that runs through California is probably our best example of certainly our most well-known example of a transform plate boundary.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Right now in the Carolinas, we are about midway between two plate boundaries, San Andreas on the west. The middle of the Atlantic Ocean is our divergent plate boundary, the Mid-Atlantic Ridge on the east. And so we are far from an active plate boundary right now, but the kinds of processes that occur at plate boundaries certainly occurred. We have records of those in the Carolinas, so we know that we used to be at various times at divergent plate boundaries, at convergent plate boundaries, and even transform plate boundaries. And so that essentially a over a billion years of geologic history recorded in the Carolinas actually shows us a lot of evidence for being located at one time at these different kinds of plate boundaries.
I see. So that entire billion-year history still lives on in the geological record that we can go out and see today.
Right? Yeah, exactly. In fact, that's one of the things that I think gets back to this notion of a geological imagination is you have to, as a geologist, be able to sort of look at the rocks and what may appear to be just sort of a pretty metamorphic rock, one that's been exposed to a lot of pressure and temperature. As a geologist, you start to look at that and you see not just a metamorphic rock, you start seeing a plate collision. And you start seeing, this is evidence of a convergent plate boundary. And so that's one of the things that that we hope people will learn from our book is how to actually read rocks in a way to get at this much bigger geologic picture that that created the rock in the first place.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned in the talk I attended that our mountains here actually in times past were a mountain range the size of the Himalayas.
Yeah. In fact, about 330 to 300 million years ago, most of the Earth's continents had collided and formed what we call a supercontinent known as Pangaea. And when we have large continental collisions like this, that is, we have tectonic plates with thick continental crust colliding with one another, we tend to get very large mountain ranges. And so certainly one place on Earth right now where this is happening is the Indian subcontinent is going underneath Asia. And this continental collision is producing a mountain range that's the Himalayas, so a very large mountain range. Mm-hmm. So we have evidence that we had a similar kind of collision when Africa and North America collided about 300 million years ago. So our ancestral Appalachians were no doubt as high as say, the Andes or the Himalayas. So they were very large mountains at that time. Also at that time, we were located at the equator. So you can imagine then that if you were standing in western North Carolina 300 million years ago, if you were at the foot of the mountains, you were sweltering in tropical heat and staring up, no doubt, at snow-capped 20,000 or 25,000-foot-high mountains. So quite a different scene than we see today.
Absolutely. I'd like to look at some of the specific examples you folks cite in the book and some of the field trips that you do recommend. But to begin our whirlwind tour, at the luncheon, you related some really enlightening facts about the geology right here in the triangle. And I'd like to get you to tell us about that so that next time any of us are driving on I-40, we can think of you and the significant geology right under our wheels. Is that one of the field trips in the book, by the way? Is there a triangle field trip?
We have one that we essentially talk about. I think the title of the chapter is the Triassic Basins. And this is focused on several locations around the triangle, mostly related to rifting. And so after the assembly of the supercontinent of Pangaea 300 million years ago, we certainly had to rift things apart. So Africa is now far away from us, separated by the Atlantic Ocean. When the Atlantic Ocean first started to open, we had the creation and the initiation of a divergent plate boundary. And this is where the continental crust starts to pull apart and stretch. And as these plates move apart and stretch, we develop very large faults. And so these faults accommodate that stretching, and as we pull the crust apart and we crack the crust all the way down into the mantle in some places, we actually take a part of the crust and drop it down along those faults. So you can imagine as we sort of pull it apart, we create a little extra space, and so some of that crust will drop down into that space we've created along these major faults.
Just like if you dug a trench, and the sides will collapse in. And
exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. It's the same kind of thing. When you dig a trench and the sides collapse, we have that happening on a crustal scale in the triangle. And so we can see evidence of this in a few places, and we describe these in our book. One is at the Durham Museum of Life and Science in the Bear Enclosure. It's an old stone quarry, but exposed in that stone quarry is a kind of igneous rock. That is a rock that cooled from an initially molten state that's called diabase. And diabase is created typically when we have rifting, because we create these large faults that essentially go down to the mantle. We tap a little bit of molten mantle down there, that is the layer below the crust, and when we partially melt mantle, we create this diabase. And so that starts rising up along these fractures, and we see a lot of this rock now preserved in the quarry walls of the Durham Museum of Life and Science. And you can find the same kind of rock scattered around other places in the triangle.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, you can also see you actually can drive down the old fault escarpments. So here in Chapel Hill, we're sitting up relatively high, topographically speaking. But as we start to drive east, whether you're on I-40 driving east around mile marker, I got to think for a second, which about 268.
Okay.
So if you're driving east on I-40 around mile 268, you may notice all of a sudden you're looking down at a vista towards Durham, and you're sort of up on high ground, and you start going down a slope. You're actually going down one of the fault scarps there. So you're actually dropping into what is called one of the Triassic basins. The Triassic is the geologic period during the time when we were rifting the continents apart. So we call these Triassic basins. Mm-hmm. Also, because they're lower, they tend to receive sediment. And so these actually got filled with sediment during the Triassic. And so we call these the Triassic basin.
Okay.
So as we're going down into the Durham Triassic basin along I-40, right around mile 268, take a look eastward, and you have this spectacular view.
Is that the Harrison Avenue that you were talking
this
about?
Actually, that's not the Harrison Avenue.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So that's sort of descending down into the basin on the western edge of the basin.
Okay.
And I think I was describing in my talk that I actually live in Raleigh, work in Chapel Hill, so I commute. And as you are driving, continuing east on I-40, say just past the airport, you start to go up a hill. And I know this hill well because this is when all the traffic starts to slow down on my evening commute.
Mm-hmm.
And so as people start to go up the hill, they start to slow down and the traffic usually starts to back up. That's because we're going up out of the basin. We're climbing up out of the basin at that time, going up the other fault that bounds the eastern edge of this Triassic basin. And so actually the trace of that fault where it crosses I-40 right there is right along Crabtree Creek.
Mm-hmm.
So as you're crossing that bridge of Crabtree Creek, you are actually crossing the old fault line. So there's a lot of evidence of a very major plate tectonic event, essentially the initiation of the opening of the Atlantic Ocean, we can actually see and experience in the triangle.
And that gives everybody something to think about next time you're stuck in traffic at the Harrison Avenue exit.
Exactly. It's an ancient problem we're dealing with.
Yeah, right. Mary Russell, tell us a little bit more about some of the other locations that you have in the book in the field trips, and what are some of the ones that really caught your fancy, and when you got there you said, oh, I can't believe how cool this is.
Well, all of our field trips in the book are public places, and a lot of them are state parks, but some of them, for example, Kevin was just talking about the Museum of Life and Science in Durham, so some of them are not state parks, and a couple of them are museums. We also, one of our field trips is to the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. And at that field trip, we talk about meteorites that have been found in the Carolinas and also gemstones, because that museum has an incredible collection of meteorites, gemstones, and a lot of very good geological exhibits. So some of my favorite spots when we were working on this book were Stone Mountain, which is in the northwestern part of the state, which is a huge exposed body of granite. It's just a really large piece of bare rock, which is very unusual to see in the Carolinas. And a lot of people have heard of Stone Mountain in Georgia. It's similar. It looks similar to that and has a similar geologic history. I also really liked Chimney Rock and DuPont State Forest. And DuPont State Forest has only been a state forest for I can't remember, 5 or 10 years. So not a lot of people know about it yet, but it has a lot of spectacular waterfalls. So that's a wonderful place to go to walk through the woods and check out some really beautiful scenery. And Chimney Rock has, once you get up on top of the chimney, there's a hiking trail up there with spectacular views and also beautiful rock. So you have scenery out over the valley, plus really interesting features in the rock to notice. And as the book was going to press, Chimney Rock, which was a private park, was put up for sale, which caused us a bit of concern because Chimney Rock is actually in our subtitle.
Right.
So we were concerned that, you know, what would happen if a developer bought Chimney Rock. Luckily, the state of North Carolina is purchasing that, and it will be part of a new state park, I think called Hickory Nut Gorge State Park. So I'm very happy that that's going to be preserved for the citizens around here, because that's truly a beautiful place. We also, some of our, another field trip where we tried to talk about history and culture is our gold chapter, which is to the Reed Gold Mine, which is a state historic site. Mm-hmm. And it's near Charlotte, and if you go there, you can walk through the old mines underground, take a tour, and they have a museum there that tell about the history of gold in the Carolinas. And gold was first discovered in North Carolina. It was the first authenticated discovery in the United States. So we had a gold rush here in North Carolina a few decades before that started in California.
That was actually the very next thing I was going to ask you about, was to tell that story. Because I think one of the really intriguing aspects of your book is the fact that you not only discuss the geology people will see when they go to these places, but also the history of the particular areas and how those two tie together, how the geology has influenced the history. Gold Rush being probably the prime example of that. Can you tell us a little bit more of that story? Because it's really interesting about how, you know, the discovery of the gold, and it was in the late 18th century, mm-hmm. I believe, influenced, planted the seeds for the economic infrastructure in that region mm-hmm. to this very day.
Yes. You know, a lot of people today don't think about how geology influences their life. But when settlers first came to the Carolinas, geology determined where they would live, how they would make their living, how they got around. And so today we're not as constrained by that, but some of the earlier effects still linger. So this gold story, in 1799, a boy found a big chunk of gold. Conrad Reed was his name. And actually for several years, he and his family didn't know what it was. So they used it as a doorstop, because it was very heavy and it was pretty. Mm-hmm. And after they found out it was gold, this gold rush started. And as I said, North Carolina was the first state producing gold. So for a while, people would just take the gold all the way from North Carolina up to the Federal Mint in Philadelphia. But that was a pretty long and dangerous trip. So the government built a mint in Charlotte, and a private organization also built a mint in Charlotte. And then after the gold rush started in California, that took the sort of the wind out of our sails as far as being the leader in the United States, but there was still a lot of gold mining that went on a smaller scale into the 1900s in and around Charlotte. And so all that gold mining and the building of the mints and the gold investing put Charlotte on the road to becoming what it is today, which is a national banking center. So that's one of those earlier effects of geology that most people probably don't know about that or think about it, but Kevin and I, of course, really enjoy thinking about all the different ways that geology affects our daily lives.
Absolutely. And my guests on Radio In Vivo today are Mary Russell Robertson, I've got to get that right, and Dr. Kevin Stewart from UNC. And we are discussing their book called Exploring the Geology of the Carolinas, A Field Guide to Favorite Places from Chimney Rock to Charleston. And it's a darn good thing you can still have Chimney Rock in there, because the alliteration works. What about the... I see on the list that you have several field trips in the book to coastal areas, and among those are sojourns to Jockey's Ridge State Park, which I think many of us have visited at the Outer Banks, and Carolina Beach State Park. And those are, you know, extremely popular tourist destinations already. So how can we go to those places or any of the coastal areas and look at them with fresh eyes and this geological imagination you call for? And what are the features of interest you discuss about those locations?
Well, I think we really wanted to include things at the coast because a lot of what is happening at the coast today, especially with development and erosion, that is geology. And I don't think mm-hmm. people necessarily know that that is actually what to call it. And
sure.
And so we decided to select a few places along the coast where there was just either interesting geology already in existence or active geologic process is happening. And one of the things that's nice about going to the coast is that you can actually have geologic change on a very short time scale. So when we talk about plate tectonics affecting things, that's interesting, but it's very slow process. Things happening at our coast today are happening very rapidly, and so we can see evidence of erosion and shifting of the islands, opening and closing of inlets on a very short time scale.
So that's really geology in action, because you're right, I don't think people think of it that quite in those terms.
Yeah, and I think sometimes people think about geology as, well, that happened millions of years ago. That's when geology started.
Right.
But no, actually, there's geology happening all the time. And so we certainly wanted to include field trips and locations where people could see active geologic processes operating as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really one of the fantastic things about the geology of the Carolinas is that we do have such a diversity where we do have things that happened over a billion years ago that were interesting, and we have things that are happening today that are interesting and very significant to development and things like that. And Jockey's Ridge is a great place to look at some active geology. It's a very large, sort of isolated sand dune, and so we don't have a lot of these very large sand dunes scattered along our coast, so one of the questions is why there?
Mm-hmm.
And it appears that there are some very large wavelength, sort of tens to hundreds of kilometer long wavelength arches in the crust that we describe in our book. And one of the troughs of these arches is near the area of Jockey's Ridge. And so that area was able to receive a lot of very young sediment. And so the presence of very thick piles of sediment that were being deposited in one of the troughs of these crustal corrugations then provided the source for wind-blown sand to sort of build up into a big dune in that area. If you head down to, say, the Cape Fear area, we're actually on the crest of one of the arches. It's a lot thinner sediment supply there. We don't get huge dunes developing in that area. And so I think it's interesting to think about Jockey's Ridge being there because we are dealing with these huge corrugations in the crustal architecture of the Carolinas. And so that's a link that isn't necessarily obvious when you're running around on the dunes. Also in those areas, they're just great examples of the kinds of structures that are produced by wind-blown sand. And so we call these things cross-bedding.
Okay.
And one of the things that we do in geology is when we're trying to understand how to interpret rocks, we often like to go to a modern setting to sort of see if we can find the kinds of clues that are contained in the rock. So, for instance, we can see crossbeds within the sand at Jockey's Ridge, and the crossbeds are due to the fact that sand makes ripples when it's deposited. If we go to Pilot Mountain, we can see an example of crossbedding that's 500 million years old. And so you can see active crossbeds forming at Jockey's Ridge, and you can go to Pilot Mountain and see 500-million-year-old crossbeds. And it turns out that the sand that forms the top of Pilot Mountain when it was first deposited was probably in a similar setting to what we're seeing now along the Carolina coast, essentially wind-blown beach sand. Today, one 500 million years ago.
So, but for the sands of time, the Wright brothers may have done their thing on Pilot Mountain
That's
if they
right.
were 500 million years ago.
That's right.
Well, that's great. And Pilot Mountain, that is also one of your trips in the book, correct? And
yes.
That's near Mount Airy, am I
That's right. It's just north of Mount Airy.
Okay.
And those crossbeds that Kevin mentioned at Pilot Mountain, they're no longer in sand. What's happened is, you know, originally the sand was deposited in crossbeds and then over millions of years was cemented into sandstone, and then during some of these continental collisions we've mentioned, metamorphosed into a very hard rock called quartzite. And because quartzite is so hard and resistant to erosion, that's why Pilot Mountain sticks up out of the landscape like that, because it has resisted erosion more than the surrounding rocks. But even though it's been metamorphosed, you can still see the features of the original sandstone, those crossbeds, which is something that is fascinating, that even after undergoing all that heat and pressure and change, you can still go and look at it, see the crossbeds, and realize, wow, this used to be sand.
Sure. So we may be looking at what Jockey's Ridge will look like in 500 million years.
That's right. Yeah, in 500 million years, that's right, Jockey's Ridge could be the top of a new Pilot Mountain.
Okay. And they'll probably raise the admission by the time that rolls around. Another coastal area that you folks talked about the other day was the, and I can't remember the name of it, the beach.
Flanner Beach.
Thank
yes.
you. Tell us a little bit about that story. That was very, very interesting.
Yeah, Flanner Beach is a recreation area along the Neuse River near Havelock.
Okay.
And if you go to Flanner Beach, the Neuse River is very broad there. It's starting to widen as you go into the sound. And it's freshwater. And so what you can see are cypress trees growing along the beach in the freshwater. And these are pretty little cypress trees. But if you start to look around in the sand, you'll start to see some much larger cypress tree stumps. And some of them get to about 8 feet in diameter. And it turns out that those cypress stumps are 125,000 years old. And so, you know, I'm sure that when people are there sitting at the beach having their picnic and they're looking at these cypress stumps, they have absolutely no idea that these are 125,000 years old.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But what that tells us is that 125,000 years ago, the environment around this area was maybe similar to what we're seeing today. It may not have been a river at that location, but at least there was maybe a freshwater swamp where these trees were growing up. If you go to the bluffs that line the Neuse River at that location, what you can see is that the layer that contains the freshwater cypress stumps is overlain by a clay layer that contains abundant marine shells. And so that is evidence that what killed those cypress trees 125,000 years ago is that they were flooded by salt water. So sea level was rising.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And as we go up the bluff, you can see then that the clay layer with the marine fossils is overlain by kind of a mixture of clay and sand, and then finally just sand. And the top of the bluff is about 20 feet higher than the current river level. And so what we see recorded at Flanner Beach is this progressive rise in sea level. So what started as a freshwater area with cypress trees growing was flooded by seawater, and the sand at the top of the bluffs is probably an indication that we actually had a barrier island, had migrated that far inland as the sea level was rising. So as we start to flood the continental margin, sea level starts to move inland, and finally the barrier islands are going to move inland.
Sure.
And we see a complete record of that preserved in the bluffs at Flanner Beach. And so I think one of the things that's very interesting about this is that we have this 20-foot rise in sea level beautifully recorded in the bluffs at Flanner Beach. And after that time, sea level dropped. Mm-hmm. But here we are, again, in a freshwater area with cypress trees growing. And it's certainly likely that we will be experiencing a 20-foot rise in sea level again as the climate warms and we start to melt either the ice sheets in Antarctica or in Greenland. A 20-foot rise in sea level wouldn't be that hard to do.
Sure.
How long it's going to take, we don't know for sure. But it's just a great record showing that 20-foot rise in sea level, how it happened in the past. And we can start to think about what it's going to look like in the future, too.
Sure. Well, that sounds like a wonderful trip to take the book in hand and have that open to that chapter and be able to see that record right there in front of you.
Yeah, and that's, I think, one of the things that we really hope people will do is get our book dirty and dog-eared and you know, torn pages and bugs on them.
You'll have to buy another one.
And buy another one, exactly. but to be able to take it out in the field with them and really look at the geology.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book got some excellent reviews, and I'm going to steal a couple of good questions from the very positive review you got in The Independent. And first of all, I just want to hear the answers. Why are the North Carolina mountains such good places to find gems? Like many people in this area, I have gone out and enjoyed panning for gemstones at the various mines and dreamt of finding a whopper, a ruby or emerald or something like that, without any success, of course. Where did all of that come from?
Well, most of our gems fall into sort of two categories. A lot of our gems come from rocks that are called pegmatite. And pegmatite is an igneous rock, so again, crystallizing from a molten state. And we have a lot of pegmatite in the Carolinas. And that's essentially related to just the long, protracted igneous activity that we've had. We have so many igneous rocks that we essentially get a lot of pegmatite. They're commonly associated with igneous rocks. Pegmatites crystallize very late in the evolution of the formation of an igneous rock. Mm-hmm. So if we take something like granite, that's a very common igneous rock. When we crystallize granite, we take all sorts of elements out of the melt as we're sort of crystallizing it. We take common elements like potassium and sodium and calcium and aluminum and silicon and oxygen. And we make our common minerals like quartz and feldspar, things that aren't necessarily too valuable. Mm-hmm. But in a melt, we also have trace amounts of much rarer elements, things like beryllium and chromium. And these elements tend to not go into the common minerals like quartz and feldspar. So they kind of hang out in the melt waiting for some mineral to mop them up. Mm-hmm. And so when the pegmatites crystallize, what they have available to them are some silicon and oxygen and some of the other more common elements, but all of these strange, rarer elements are waiting now to go into a mineral. And so when the pegmatites finally crystallize, then we start getting things like beryllium silicates, which make mineral gems like emerald.
I see.
So a lot of our gemstones are coming from these pegmatites that usually have these sort of unusual elements, and because they're rare, they tend to be more valuable.
Mm-hmm.
The other way in which we get gemstones in the Carolinas is essentially aluminum oxide, Al2O3, is a mineral that if you put certain kinds of other little trace elements into it, you'll get things like sapphire and ruby. And Al2O3, aluminum oxide, forms when you have not enough silicon around. So in rocks that are very rich in silicon, we make other less interesting minerals. If you don't have a lot of silicon around, then you make this aluminum oxide or corundum, and if you tint it just right, you make beautiful gemstones.
I see.
The mantle of the Earth tends to have less silicon than the crust of the Earth. The problem is it's far down below our feet, so we don't typically see the mantle. In the long history of the Carolinas, we have had enough continental collisions where we have actually taken not only the crust, but the mantle, and we have pried it up during these collisions, and we have exposed mantle actually now in the cores of our mountain ranges. And so when we have this exposed silica-poor mantle-type rock, we can actually then get corundum and get things like rubies and sapphires. So that's really why we get our gemstones in the Carolinas.
Wow, what a great explanation.
Oh, okay.
I've never heard it explained so well. This weekend, I've got to get out there and, you know, dig.
Yeah, well, let me know if you find anything good.
Well, chances of that are highly unlikely, of course. Something I certainly want to ask both of you about is earthquake activity in the Carolinas. I think it's maybe not terribly commonly known, with, especially with so many people, you know, moving here from other areas and, you know, not having lived here for long. There are earthquakes in North Carolina, and it is, you know, actually a fairly active zone. Can you elaborate on that in terms of the geology of the region?
The field trip where we talk about earthquakes is our Charleston field trip. And a lot of people don't know that there was a really big earthquake in Charleston in, was it 1886? Where there was a lot of damage and some loss of life, and the shocks from that quake were felt as far away as New York and Cuba. And people around here in Chapel Hill, people woke up, ran out of their houses, and got written up in the newspaper, what was that all about last night, all that shaking and quivering. So if you've been to Charleston, you can see evidence of the earthquake. A lot of the buildings have bolts on them that were installed after the earthquake to prevent any more movement of the walls. But in our book, in addition to just telling a little bit about the earthquake, and we include some newspaper reports, we also talk about the geology of that particular quake and about the possibility for more of that sort of thing in the future.
And I think with Charleston, that was a large quake, about a magnitude 7, which, for those of you familiar with California quakes, that's about the same size as the 1989 Loma Prieta quake, the one that happened during the World Series. So that certainly caused a lot of damage in that area, so you can imagine the kind of damage that occurred in the Carolinas following that quake.
Sure.
The one thing that's strange about our earthquakes is that earthquakes typically occur at plate boundaries, and we are not located at a plate boundary.
Right.
And so...
So we're not along a fault line such as San Andreas.
Right? Exactly, exactly. So we haven't got a easily identifiable culprit for our earthquakes. Mm-hmm. So Charleston, for some reason, is a seismically active zone. For some reason, stress is building up in the crust in this area. It's not building up at the same rate as it does at an active plate boundary. It's much more slow, slower buildup. And so when we have a magnitude 7 quake, say, in Charleston, that is probably relieving stress that built up over hundreds or even thousands of years. So we don't expect to have a lot of these quakes. Mm-hmm. And if we go into the western part of the Carolinas, we actually have quite a few little quakes. The largest quake in western North Carolina was in 1916. It was probably about a magnitude 5. Mm-hmm, so that's sure. Certainly a good shake and could crack some chimneys and things like that. Mm-hmm. More common are quakes that are less than magnitude 3, which if you're on top of it, gives you kind of a good jolt, but doesn't really cause much damage. And so we have those scattered throughout the western part of the Carolinas. And again, we don't have a good explanation for why those quakes are occurring. They are relieving some stress that is building up in the crust in this area, but there's no clearly identifiable fault that's the culprit.
I see. Well, I have the impression that Winston-Salem area seems to have these small quakes every so often.
Yeah, about a year ago, Winston-Salem had, I think, 4 within about a month, or even a shorter time, magnitude 2 or 3. So little quakes, little shakes. Mm-hmm. If you're on top of it, it's kind of a bang, but not a damaging quake. And
so all those people are going to be scared to death and move to California.
that's right. And again, those are clearly relieving some buildup of stress. Why Winston-Salem? Why then is a good geologic mystery.
So we don't seem to be at any real risk of a major earthquake here, though. That we know of.
In fact, you know, in 1885, people in Charleston would have said that they would never experience a large quake. Mm-hmm. And then in 1886, they did. So,
never say never.
Never say never, yeah. But we certainly have no reason to expect large quakes anytime soon.
I see. Now, what has the role been of volcanic activity? Obviously, we don't have any active volcanoes here in the Carolinas, but I'm sure we did at some point in the distant past. Well, what was the role of that kind of activity?
Well, every time you've got a convergent plate boundary, you generate volcanoes. And so if you go back in the geologic history of the Carolinas, we have got lots of evidence for convergent plate boundaries and associated volcanism. So here in Chapel Hill, we are sitting in a belt of rocks that we actually call the Carolina terrane that consists mostly of volcanic rocks. And so if your listeners are familiar with kind of the area just kind of north of town, there often you'll see a couple of peaks. One is called Bald Mountain. One is called Blackwood Mountain.
Okay.
Those are actually remnants of volcanic rocks. They're not volcanoes, even though they're little mountains. But they are some particularly resistant volcanic rocks make up the peaks of those mountains, and that's why they're sort of standing up high. If you were to go around the Pacific Ocean right now, most of the Pacific Ocean is rimmed by a kind of plate boundary called a convergent plate boundary, and that occurs typically when you've got oceanic crust that is sinking down into the mantle. And as that sinks down into the mantle, it releases some water, it tends to melt a little bit of the mantle, and we generate volcanoes. So there are lots of active volcanoes in the Andes, the Aleutians. Mount St. Helens is mm-hmm. a good example.
Sure.
Through Indonesia, Japan. And so when we've got convergent plate boundaries, we tend to generate volcanoes. So if we look at the Carolina terrane that we're sitting in here in Chapel Hill, we see evidence that there was a lot of volcanism in this area about 500 to 600 million years ago. And the volcanoes, for the most part, are long eroded away. And what we see instead are the magma chambers now exhumed that were feeding the volcanoes. And so there are a few scattered outcrops that you can see even on campus, on the Chapel Hill campus, that are parts of these exhumed magma chambers for the volcanoes. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the igneous rocks that we see sort of scattered throughout the Carolinas are the magma chambers of ancient volcanoes. Mary Russell was talking about Stone Mountain earlier. That is an exhumed magma chamber of a volcano that was active about 335 million years ago.
Wow, and the rock that forms is more resistant to erosion, and thus it tends to be preserved.
Yes, typically these igneous rocks are much more resistant to erosion. And so part of that topographic difference that we see going from Chapel Hill down to the Durham Basin is because we are on this really resistant, much more resistant rock here in Chapel Hill, this old magma chamber.
I see. So we actually have some things to look at right here practically at our doorstep.
Yeah, in fact, I think that's one of the things we hope people will start to notice in developing this idea of a geological imagination, mm-hmm. is that if you just start looking around, you start noticing a lot of rocks. And so every rock has an interesting story to tell. And every hill and every valley has some geologic basis behind it. And in some cases, it's really a spectacular story.
Yeah, absolutely. So is there going to be a sequel to the book? Is there going to be a new edition at some point, an update?
That's a good question, Ernie. That's a question we don't know the answer to.
I see. Well, we certainly hope so. I'm sure you've just scratched the igneous surface of what you could be talking about.
Yeah, one of the things that is good about writing a geology book is that the geology is not going to change too rapidly,
mm-hmm.
but maybe new parks might be opened up and things like that. And the interpretations of the geology might change. And so I think one of the things readers will get from our book is actually how geologists come up with these explanations that we've been talking about. And some of the things that we describe in our book are really well established. Other things are sort of actively being investigated now, and the interpretations could change. So in the future, maybe not the geologically distant future, we may revise some things.
Okay, that sounds reasonable. Well, we are actually approaching the end of our hour together, and Kevin, I particularly, you know, we've spent the whole program talking about the book, which is great, but you are an active research scientist, and in fairly briefly, What are the big questions in the world of geological sciences today?
Boy, there are a lot of big questions. My particular branch of geology deals with issues like plate tectonics. And so I think one of the things that people are actively working on is trying to understand plate tectonic processes at a shorter human time scale. So plate tectonics are creating a lot of the geologic disasters in the world, large earthquakes, large tsunamis, volcanic eruptions. And so trying to make a bridge between processes that are very slow and sometimes very hard to monitor, like plate tectonics, and relating that information to more immediate hazards in geology. So I think a lot of geology is dealing with understanding the Earth processes on a human time scale that really affect human events.
I see. Excellent. Well, we'll have to get back together and then and talk about some of those big questions in more detail.
Yeah, I'd enjoy that.
And Mary Russell, what's next for you? Has publishing a book opened new windows of opportunity for you?
Well, after working on this book, which was a very long process, we actually did the research and the writing took us 3 years. That had a lot of breaks in there for the book being out for review or being copy edited. Mm-hmm. But after such a long process, right now I'm really enjoying working on a lot of small projects. So I'm writing magazine articles and working on science curriculum materials and enjoying the different time scale of those kinds of projects. and also enjoying looking at different kinds of science.
I'm sure the steady paycheck doesn't hurt
either. Yes, that's right. You get paid quicker.
I know the name of that tune. Well, folks, thanks so much. The book is called Exploring the Geology of the Carolinas, a field guide to favorite places from Chimney Rock to Charleston. And it is published by UNC Press. And we will have a link to the website where you can order a copy of the book if you go to the Radio En Vivo website. So it's easily found, and I assume it's in all the bookstores, as they say. Kevin Stewart and Mary Russell Robison, it has been a fascinating hour, and it's gone by all too quickly. And I want to thank you for taking the time and coming in and enlightening our Radio En Vivo listening audience to the tremendously versatile geology we can all study and appreciate right here in the Carolinas.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thanks, Ernie.
And we have got some terrific guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio En Vivo. You can check out the website for the lineup, and it is updated regularly as we book new appearances. So please join us again next time for Radio En Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM-LP, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we ask that you make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. See you next time.